Exodus 3, the last verses, summarize what's going to come in Exodus. They will listen to your voice, and you and the elders of Israel shall go to the king of Egypt and say to him, Yahweh, the God of the Hebrews, has met with us. Let us now go a 3-day journey into the wilderness so that we may sacrifice to Yahweh, our God. I know, however, that the king of Egypt will not let you go, this is God speaking, unless compelled by a mighty power. So I will stretch out my arm and strike Egypt with all my wonders that I'll perform in it. After that, he will let you go. So God's giving an inside, a bit of information to Moses, as the story tells. I'll bring this people into such favor with the Egyptians that when you go, you will not go empty-handed. Each woman shall ask her neighbor and any woman living in the neighbor's house for jewelry of silver and gold and clothing, and you shall put them on your sons and your daughters, and so you shall plunder the Egyptians. Plunder like an army would plunder a defeated force. You take all their, you know, whatever. So that Israel's going to be conquerors and Egypt is going to be conquered by God's power. And you've got to ask yourself the question, didn't God love the Egyptians? Weren't they his chosen people? Does God go around plundering people? Does God go around with a sword? And does God go around beheading people? Akbar, you know, God is wonderful. And so, is that our God? Is that Jesus' God? It's the God of the people who, not quite, but. So we've got to. Yahweh said to Moses in Midian, go back to Egypt. All those who were seeking your life are dead. Does that ring a bell anywhere before I do it? Herod and Matthew and Joseph and Mary. In that, it's not history, it's not even event, not meant to be, it's Midrash, meditations, the life of Jesus. So this, okay. So Moses took his wife and his sons, put them on a donkey and went back to the land of Egypt. And Moses carried the staff of God in his hand. And there's the Matthew text, which you know, Matthew 2, which has got, it's a quote from Exodus. Say to Pharaoh, thus says Yahweh, Israel is my firstborn son. I said to you, let my son go that he may worship me, but you refused to let him go. Now I'll kill your firstborn son. What kind of an image of God is that? Don't we have to improve on that? Or do we say the word of the Lord, thanks be to God, and get on to the responsorial psalm? We've got to be so careful reading the Old Testament. Have Jesus with you all the time saying, look, yeah, I know that's the best I can do, but I say to you, you've got to have that happening all the time. So this is about who God chooses. And according to the writers of this, they had no doubt that God chose them. But they had not the foggiest idea that God actually chose the Moabites, the Ammonites, the Aborigines of Australia, and of course, the Irish. God chooses everybody. And the Israeli settlers, you know, the rabid right-wing settlers that say, this is our land, God gave us this land, so we've got to do what Joshua was supposed to have done and get everybody out, kill them, shoot them, take their land. They get it all from here. We can't blame them directly. This is what they're getting, just as the Islamists getting their stuff from the Quran. It just happens that the texts are very imperfect and have to be fulfilled by someone better than all that, namely Jesus. Exodus 6, God said to Moses, I am Yahweh. I appear to Abraham, Isaac and Jacob as God Almighty, the Hebrews El Shaddai, the God of the mountain. An ancient word for God, you know, way back. But by my name Yahweh, I did not make myself known to them. I also established my covenant with them to give them the land of Canaan, the land in which they are resident as aliens. I have also heard the groaning of the Israelites from the Egyptians are holding as slaves, and I have remembered my covenant. Another little text. We've already had that, actually, somewhere else from another source. But that put it in here as well, just to impress us on it. Say therefore to the Israelites, I am Yahweh. I'll free you from the burdens of the Egyptians and deliver you from slavery to them. I will redeem you with an outstretched arm and with mighty acts of judgment. I will take you as my people. Very burned into the psyche, beautifully, of the people of Israel. They are God's people. Sadly, it never dawned on them that the Samaritans were God's people, and the Romans were God's people, and the Greeks were God's people, and the Parthians were God's people. And that's what Jesus knew, and that's what the church picked up. And so Paul grabbed it, Barnabas, and many others, and took it to the world, telling people to come as you are. And Paul said, you don't have to become a Jew to become a Christian. Just learn to love, for God's sake, your way. You shall know that I am Yahweh, who has freed you from the burden of the Egyptians. I'll bring you into the land that I swore to Abraham, Isaac and Jacob. I'll give it to you as a possession, for I am Yahweh. There's a fair bit of repetition going on here. Why? Because you've got different sources. Some of the sources of this writing come from the northern kingdom, some come from the southern kingdom, and so they put them all together. Exodus 6 goes on to give a genealogy in which the priestly school traces the priestly office back to Levi through Aaron. Well, the priests are writing this, and they're going to make sure they've got a genealogy that takes them right back to Moses, who, by the way, was of the house of Levi, as was Aaron. That's interesting. We're going to see an interesting thing. The Levites didn't have any land in Canaan. They weren't given land. They had special portions of the sacrifices, but they're not one of the tribes that have got land. That looks likely to me that the Moses people that came in, because you don't get land in their world. You own the land. The land's you. So you don't just parcel out land the way we did in Africa, for example. What a hide we had. And we're causing trouble still by that. Or Middle East, by the way. We just drew a line on the map. We mean in Europe. Hence all the Bibbon problems. Part of them in here. So you've got this going on. And were the Moses people that came in from the desert with the new idea of Yahweh, are they the ones that took this gave the spiritual energy to these tribes that were already there, and therefore the tribes said, well, you know, we'll sacrifice and you can have a tenth of the sacrifice. And I'm only guessing, but it looks highly likely to me. Then come the 10 plagues, from the Latin plangere, which means to strike the best, or the Italian piangere, to weep. So a plague means something terrible that you're just fearful of and repentant of, and a punishment, whatever. Punishment. That's one reason. Punishing the Egyptians for being in Egypt. Doesn't sound too nice to be. What kind of a God sorts out that up? And the second thing is, no, so they'll know Yahweh, and they'll know that Yahweh is more powerful than Ra or Hapi or any of the gods. This is clearly the mentality of the people writing the document. It's really got, could I say, nothing to do with God. But this is what they're doing, and they're doing it within their own limits. Yahweh demonstrates his superiority over the gods of the most powerful nation on earth. That's an insight that's very important, and a good insight. But there's a few oversights in it as well. The stories were developed as support for peasants in uprising against the tyrants of pre-monarchy Israel and continued as examples of the prophetic critique of aristocratic monarchs. God will strike you the way he struck Pharaoh. So behave yourself, follow the Torah, look after the poor. So it's good and it's not good. Let's go through them. First plague, water is turned to blood. And in the story, the magicians managed to do that too. Don't ask me how. When the Nile doesn't flood, this is a fact of history. It's been changed a bit by the Aswan Dam, but let's leave that out for a minute. Decaying algae and red soil, which is all of the desert, The river becomes red and decayed, and fish don't live in it, and we know that from our own world too, in different parts. So the river is killed. Now that's the image behind it, but they're seeing a theological meaning in it. They're saying the god of the Nile, and that is so important to Egypt because the Nile is their lifeblood, pardon the use of the word blood, but that's irrelevant, God of Yahweh is defeating Hapi, the god of the Nile. Wow, that's terrific. God, these are the Psalms. God displayed his signs in Egypt, his miracles in the fields of Zoan. That's in the delta. He turned their rivers to blood so that they couldn't drink of their streams, says Psalm 78:43. Psalm 105:26 reads, Yahweh sent his servant Moses and Aaron, whom he had chosen. They performed the signs among them and miracles in the land of Ham. He turned their waters into blood and caused the fish to die. Do you see the tradition going on? And they're singing about it in the temple and they're reinforcing their faith. Good faith, beautiful faith, but limited. And they didn't know Jesus. So don't blame them for being limited. The apocalypse, John's letter. The second angel poured his bowl over the sea. It became like the blood of a corpse, and every living thing in the sea died. The third angel poured his blood over the rivers and springs of water, and they became blood. You know where the image is coming from? This is about Roman power all through this part of at the end of the century. Domitian, the emperor. And it's saying, no, there's something more powerful than Rome. It's God. So put your faith in God. Second plague, frogs. Poor little frogs. They're all over the place, though. And the psalm, these are natural things that happen every now and then, like mice, you know, in our country. So, but they're all happening within a few weeks, thanks to Moses, God through Moses. Well, it's the story, for God's sake. Let it speak as a story. Psalm 78, God sent among them frogs which destroyed them. Psalm 105, their land swarmed with frogs even in the chambers of the king. When the king went to the toilet, he got bitten by a frog. Revelation 16:13, I saw three foul spirits, this is like frogs, coming from the mouth of the dragon, from the mouth of the beast and from the mouth of the false prophet. Are you okay with this? Just imagine it. I'm rushing through too fast for you, but it's clearly nothing to do with facts or superficial stuff you could put a footnote on. This is drama. Third plague, gnats. The magicians couldn't manage this one. Don't ask me why, we're told in the story. And Psalm 105, Yahweh spoke and there came gnats throughout the country. Fourth plague, flies, or are they scarab beetles? We're not sure because the Hebrew text could be either. Probably the latter, but okay. Now this is affecting the king. And in the meantime, of course, Pharaoh is saying, well, you can go. And then he retracts and says, no, you're saying, go stay. So it's building up to a big drama. Something's going to be an explosion soon. God sent them swarms of flies, says Psalm 78, and devoured them. Psalm 105, Yahweh spoke and there came swarms of flies throughout the country. This is the living tradition through the hymns of the Second Temple period. Fifth plague, the livestock are killed by pestilence. Well, that happened every now and then, of course. But here it's done because God got Moses to do it. And Pharaoh's there getting scared stiff each time. God gave over their cattle to the pestilence, says Psalm 78, and their flocks to thunderbolts. Now the calf of Ur-Mer in Egypt was an incarnation of Ra and was worshipped in Heliopolis. The bull Bacchus is at Thebes and the bull Apis at Memphis. So bulls were part of the powerful animals that were kind of worshipped, the spiritual element of the bulls. And they were gods, really, in whatever. So when the livestock are hit by pestilence, that's a laugh at these pseudo-gods of these famous Egyptian sanctuaries. Sixth plague, soot causes boils and sores. Deuteronomy 28 says, Yahweh will strike you on the knees and on the legs with grievous boils, of which you cannot be healed, from the sole of your foot to the crown of your head. So he's not mucking around either. Revelations again. The first angel went and poured his bowl on the earth, and a foul and painful sore came of those who had the mark of the beast and worshipped its image. Rome. And they cursed the God of heaven because of their pains and sores and didn't repent of their deeds, says Revelation. Picking the stuff up, obviously, from the book of Exodus. Seventh plague, hail destroys the workers and the animals. Psalm 78, I'm not reading Exodus, it's there for you to read, but I'm just giving you the ongoing tradition. God destroyed their vines with hail and their sycamores with frost. Psalm 105. Yahweh gave them hail for rain and lightning that flashed through their land. Again, Revelation picks it up. Huge hailstones, each weighing about 100 pounds. Come on, no mucking around here. What would that do to your car if you left it out in the gate? So 100 pounds dropped from heaven on people, and they cursed God for the plague of the hail. So fearful was that plague. You should be enjoying this. Eighth plague, locusts. Psalm 78, God gave their crops to the caterpillar and the fruit of the labor to the locusts. Psalm 105, Yahweh spoke and the locusts came, and young locusts without number. They devoured all the vegetation in the land and ate up the fruit of their ground. These are natural phenomena that happen periodically. Ninth plague, now wait a minute, 3 days of darkness. Now they had eclipses of the sun. And there are, we know, one of the big, I've forgotten where the island was in the Aegean, blew up, you know, and it covered this part of the world for days, as it can. Even that one in Scandinavia, you know, they had to take the airplanes out because it... So that happens. It happened. That's the image behind this. But this isn't talking about that. This is talking about a divinely induced punishment. And the high king god of Egypt is Ra, the god of the sun. So God, Yahweh, is defeating Ra. Psalm 105, Yahweh sent darkness and made the land dark. Revelation, the fifth angel poured his bowl on the throne of the beasts. So what happened to Pharaoh then is going to happen now to the Roman power. And the kingdom was plunged in darkness. Tenth plague, this is not a natural phenomenon and needs to be treated with the greatest insight and care. Moses said, this one's built up to, but this is going to be the big one. Moses said, thus says Yahweh, about midnight I'll go out through Egypt. Every firstborn in the land of Egypt shall die, from the firstborn of the Pharaoh who sits on his throne to the firstborn of the female slave who's behind the handmill, and all the firstborn of the livestock. The cows are going to cop it as well, and the goats and the sheep. Poor little things. This is God's big plan. So that you may know that Yahweh makes a distinction between Egypt and Israel. You're my firstborn, not them. All of these officials of yours shall come down to me, and they'll bow low to me, saying, leave us, you and all the people who follow after. After that I will leave. And in hot anger Moses left Pharaoh. And we're getting, this is tough. Pharaoh doesn't believe them, unfortunately. But it happened. Of course, it didn't happen historically. You're okay with that, aren't you? Not every poor little mum's just had her first baby, and she lives out in the wilderness somewhere up near the high, I don't know, somewhere up the Nile River. And you're the grandmother, and she has her first little baby, and it's killed by God to prove a point to Pharaoh. If that's your image of God, you'll end up with Isis chopping heads off in God's name. But it isn't your image of God. And you don't have to think, oh, gee, my image of God is not right because it says in the Bible. But there are people who do that, you know. Quote the Bible as God's word, not realizing it's a response to God's word. And it's a response to God's word heard by human ears that are quite defective. and don't know the way Jesus knew. So their hearts were good, probably, but half done. Here's Exodus 12, and this is talking about something that wasn't practiced there, and nor was it practiced. But it seems at the time of Josiah, we're getting into the 600s BC, and then particularly after the exile, that this became an important feast, and it still is. It's done in a different way in homes now, but Yahweh said to Moses and Aaron in the land of Egypt, "This month will mark for you the beginning of the months. It shall be the first month of the year for you." They must have argued about that a heck of a lot, because some of the Jewish communities had the new year was in autumn, some had it in spring. And there was a change before the exile and after the exile. It's all over the place. So if you study the Old Testament and try and work out which is the first month and which is the seventh month, you'll get totally confused because the sources are confusing. All right. So anyhow, the people who wrote this, they knew what the first month was. "Tell the whole congregation of Israel that on the 10th of this month, they're to take a lamb from each household, without blemish, a year old male, on the 14th day." Why the 14th day? That's the full moon. The months always began with the new moon. Someone would go, when they could see the little slither from the hilltop, and then everyone winded up their watches and got the time right, kind of thing. And then the 14th day is a full moon. That's when they had all their feasts. Of course they did. "So on the 14th day of this month, the whole assembled congregation of Israel shall slaughter this lamb at twilight, between sunset and dark." That's twilight for them. "They shall take some of the blood and put it on the two doorposts on the lintel of their houses in which they eat. They'll eat the lamb that same night. They'll eat it roasted over the fire with unleavened bread, because they haven't got time to leaven it. It's got to be moving quickly. And bitter herbs, because they're going to escape by night quickly. You ready? "This is how they'll eat it. Make your loins girded." So put your thing around your lap. "Your sandals on your feet. Your staff in your hand." If you're not thinking of Jesus' commands to the apostles when they go out on mission, whether Jesus commanded that or not, I haven't the faintest idea. But the point of it is, the mission of the church is like this. That's where the quote comes from. Staff in hand, because you've got on a journey, and sandals on your feet. You're ready for a journey. Baptism is being ready for a journey. We're all meant to be. "Eat it hurriedly. It is the Passover of Yahweh." He's going to pass over the houses with the blood, because they're Israelite houses. And he's going to get the angel, kill all the firstborn there, but he won't go in there because he can see by the blood. And you can use that. You can see the images. You can see the blood of the lamb, can't you, there in the New Testament, and the protective. What we've got to do is not look at the negative side of it. Like, God protects me, but he won't protect them. Because Jesus has come in the meantime and shown us that the Father loves everybody. He loves the good and the bad. He loves everyone. Now, not everyone's welcoming the love, and that's a problem. But God's love isn't selective. "I'll strike down the firstborn in the land of Egypt, human beings and animals, all the gods of Egypt. I will execute judgment. I'm Yahweh. When I see the blood, I will pass over you. This day will be a day of remembrance for you. You shall celebrate it as a festival to Yahweh. Well, throughout your generations, you shall observe it as a perpetual ordinance." Like we celebrate the death and resurrection of Jesus every Easter. 2 Kings chapter 23, the authors of that. "No such Passover had been kept since the days of the judges who judged Israel, or during all the days of the kings of Israel or the kings of Judah. But in the 18th year of King Josiah," that's 622 BC, "this Passover was kept to Yahweh." So for centuries, this wasn't being kept against the will of God, according to the text here. Ezra, 450 BC, "On the 14th day of the first month, the returned exiles kept the Passover." They couldn't do it in Egypt, but they kept it then. So this begins a kind of continuous keeping of this feast. And a lot of the literature comes out of this period. Mark 14:12, on the first day of unleavened bread, when the Passover lamb is sacrificed, his disciples said to him, "Where do you want us to go and make preparations for you to eat the Passover?" You're familiar with this from the Gospels. Problem. In John's Gospel, and the scholars suggest, you got it right, the Passover was on the Sabbath this year. The Friday was the evening of the Passover. Jesus, having the meal on the Thursday, it wasn't a Passover meal, despite people trying to get it all connected. It wasn't a Passover meal. In fact, there's no lamb there at that meal. There's no Passover lamb. It hasn't been slaughtered yet. You see the problems? So they're kind of low. Jesus died on the occasion of the Passover. That's enough. So they make all the links, and he made it. Because he thought, well, I mightn't be here tomorrow night. So it's like celebrating Christmas on the 24th of December with a dying grandfather who's probably going to die that night. So you celebrate Christmas with him, and all the kids gather. What's wrong with that, isn't it? So that's what they're doing. They're having the pre-Passover meal. And it's given all this Passover significance by the synoptics. John actually says, no, it wasn't a Passover meal. He's not arguing with them. He's just telling us another part of what was going on. There's Luke, beautiful John. Before the festival of the Passover, Jesus knew that the hour had come to depart from this world and go to the Father. Having loved his own in the world, he loved them to the end. And when Jesus died on the cross in John, that was when the Passover lambs were being slaughtered. For the meal that night, Jesus will be dead, and the feast tomorrow on the Sabbath. I don't have a problem with that. You shouldn't have a problem with that by now. We're just looking at different dramatists. They want us to link this because Jesus linked it with the Passover. He is the Passover lamb in the gospel story. All the New Testament is about unleavened bread and Passover, all the texts, and I'll have to leave them. Exodus 12:21, Moses gives instructions for the rite. Slaughter the Passover lamb. Did Moses give this instruction? Probably not. But when the authors write it, they want to take all their feasts back to Moses, back to Sinai, back to the beginnings. So they've got this happening there in the story to reinforce the need to do it. Take a bunch of hyssop, dip it in the blood that is in the basin. Touch the lintel and the two doorposts with the blood of the basin. You're with me on this? And do you remember in John's Gospel when Jesus said he was thirsting, the soldier held up a hyssop stick. Well, the hyssop stick's like that. If you hold it up, just go, you can't hold up a hyssop stick. It's just flopping. But he brings in hyssop stick here to make sure we're thinking of the Passover lamb. That's, again, not a detail that's picked up by a camera, but a theological awareness that is put in the drama by the evangelist. John 19, a jar full of wine, I just said that to you, a branch of hyssop held to his mouth. Are you with me? The 10th plague now, at midnight, Exodus 12:29, at midnight Yahweh struck down all the firstborn in the land of Egypt. Nothing of this is recorded in any Egyptian thing, and of course it didn't happen, and of course God didn't do it. But it's a powerful way of saying Israel is the firstborn, not Egypt, because Egypt claimed to be the like America might do today, you know, the greatest of the nations, the whatever, Christian nation too, by the way, just for the record. And so it's got all that going. So Yahweh struck down all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, from the firstborn of Pharaoh who sat on his throne to the firstborn of the prisoner who was in the dungeon, and all the firstborn of the livestock. He's already said he's going to do it. He does it. Then Pharaoh summoned Moses and Aaron in the night and said, "Get up, go away from my people, you and the Israelites. Go worship Yahweh as you said. Take your flocks, take your herds, and be gone and bring a blessing on me too. So Pharaoh's kind of cow. So the people took their dough before it was leavened. They're in a hurry. With their kneading bowls wrapped up in their cloaks and their shoulders, and the Israelites had done as Moses told them, and they asked the Egyptians for jewelry and silver and gold, you heard about that, and for clothing, and Yahweh, everyone's frightened stiff of this group because of what's happened, given the people favour in the sight of the Egyptians, so that they let them have what they asked, and so they plundered the Egyptians. Psalm 78 talks about that, as does Psalm 105. And we now finish with some music. And I've got a picture there from Tintoretto of the Last Supper, because I think our themes are, if I've rushed to forgive me, it's all about a warped way of putting it, but it's about God's choice. It's about the chosen ones. And oh, that everybody in the world felt chosen by God. That would be superb. It's what Jesus wants. That's what the church is about, especially the Catholic Church. It means all embracing. The Mother Church wants to embrace the whole world.